You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 2nd, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
And we are not at Dragon Con.
No, we're not.
Boo.
Boo. Only going to have a virtual Dragon Con this year. No in-person. And it's September already. This year is flying by. Not that I'm upset about that, but...
Oh. Yeah. Press the fast-forward button.
October is a little bit closer.
Yeah, Bob,
yes, it
right?
Is.
Why, is that, you like October, Bob?
We're doing our haunt. We're doing our haunt this year in the woods, Forest of
gonna
Fear.
Do it. Social distancing.
Oh, haunt. All of that. All of that. Everybody's going to have a mask. And the workers, the customers, everybody needs a mask. Distancing. You can only go, you know, you can only go in with the people that you arrived with. No bunching up. So we're not going to sell anything. They're not going to even have to touch anything. Even open a door. So it's
Just it being outside is big.
Right. Yeah. You'll be outside.
Yeah, it's actually perfect. Yeah, it's outside. People have to space out anyway in their groups and everyone's wearing a mask.
Right.
It's like perfect. Right.
Right. So, but I still don't know what to expect. I'm sure we'll see a fraction of what we saw last year, but it'll be fun just decorating and getting in the mood, doing stuff. But yeah, so we're doing it, man.
So COVID-19 is still moving along. And worldwide, there are over 26 million cases, 866,000 deaths. And in the U.S., we are over 182,000 deaths, over 6 million cases. And, you know, we're still at a very high level. If you look at the new reported cases per day, we're kind of plateauing, you know, at around 40,000 cases a day. And it's still higher than it was any time from April through June.
Yeah, because it's in deep. It's everywhere.
Yeah, it's in the rural areas now.
Right. Like people are acting like it's over. It's like it's still greater than it was during that beginning shutdown part where people thought that the pandemic was happening. And of course, school is opening up now. They delayed my daughter's school by 2 weeks, so just September 15th.
Oh, really?
I wonder why.
They just weren't ready.
Gotcha.
They're just not ready. You know what I mean? There's so much to do. Schools are just, they're scrambling. A lot of them don't have the resources. And the data coming in, I know I think I mentioned this previously, but I wrote again about this because there was a couple of new studies, you know, just asking the question of how susceptible are kids to COVID-19? And there's two studies that came out, one from South Korea. And they found that South Korea is doing extensive testing and contact tracing. So they have, like, if you test positive, they will keep testing you until you test negative. So it was a great way to see, well, how long do people have the virus in them? And they found that children who tested positive by nasal swab will continue to have the virus in their nasal cavity for 2 to 3 weeks. Children are less likely to get sick. When they do get sick, it's more likely to look like a cold than COVID. They get milder symptoms. There is a UK study which showed that if a child gets hospitalized, it's less than 19 with COVID, the mortality rate is only 1%, whereas if you take all ages together, more like 27%. But that's if you're admitted, not with COVID. That's admitted to the hospital with COVID. So it's a lot less than adults. But still, 1%, like they were saying, oh, that's very real. I'm sure parents will be reassured by that. Really? I would not be reassured if my child had a 1% mortality rate. I'm sorry. These are the three questions. Do they contract the virus? Do they get sick from the virus? And do they pass along the virus? So clearly they contract it. They're much less likely to get sick. And those who did have a negative outcome were much more likely to have an underlying condition, but that could just be like asthma, that, or it could be also if they had a serious illness like cancer, you know, then they were much more likely to get admitted to the ICU and to die from COVID than children who were healthy at baseline. But and clearly now there's evidence that children can contract the virus and can be carriers of the virus. They also have higher viral titers than adults. So even though they don't get sick from it, there's a lot of virus in their nose. But we haven't fully closed the circle on proving, like, we don't know how likely they are to pass it on.
Right.
That's the one bit, one thing we still don't know. So maybe there'll be some research coming out showing that. But I mean, it doesn't, it's a pretty safe bet that if they have the virus, they have high titers of the virus, why would they not pass it on? Like, it seems likely that that's, you know, we need to assume that that's the case unless we can prove otherwise. So you're right. The whole point about going to school is they'll be spreading the virus around and bringing it home in countries that still haven't, you know, still have the pandemic raging. That school can kick off another wave. You know, that's a very legitimate concern.
Absolutely.
And so schools are doing what they can with the resources that they have, but they're in the U.S. anyway. There really isn't a national plan. And a lot of schools are saying, we're doing what we can, but we don't really have the resources to do this properly.
And it seems like every time I turn on the TV, another school has, oops, we're going to close again. We're back online because we had 100 cases or 200 cases or more.
Yeah.
Steve, what do you think is going to happen? Like, I know this is off the cuff, but schools start 2 to 3 weeks go by. Where do you think we're going to be?
Well, the curve's already turning around in the U.S. You know, if you look at that 7-day average, you know, it sort of peaked in the middle of July, then it's been heading down, and now it's flattening and maybe even turning up a little bit as schools are reopening. So that's what I think is going to happen. it's what's happening right now. The question is it, you know, again, you can't predict the future. Is this just a little blip, or is it going to turn into a significant second wave? You know, we just have to wait and see. But again, there are reasons for concern. Meanwhile, the CDC just told the state's health departments to expect the first doses of vaccine to distribute by as early as November 1st.
Suspicious date.
It doesn't coincide with anything.
And that's after phase 3 trials are going to be done by November 1st?
No. I don't think so.
Well,
I don't know.
You know,
one might say they're rushing to meet that deadline.
Yeah, they're clearly rushing. There's literally Operation Warp Speed where they're just clearing the decks of any red tape, and they're trying to make the approval process as quickly as possible. And they're even allowing for the manufacture of the vaccine before the clinical trial is even done, so that if it's positive, if it works, they already have doses ready to go. But of course, you know, distribution in November would be, if everything works out, it would only be a very limited number. It would essentially be to healthcare workers only. And Fauci and others are saying, yeah, maybe we'll get the vaccine will be like significantly rolled out by the second half of 2021. But it does seem like there's, you know, the CDC has made a couple of questionable statements recently that seems to be politically motivated.
Yeah.
I just don't see how a phase 3 trial could be even remotely close by then, because the thing about human trials specifically is that we cannot give people COVID. It's unethical. But you have to literally just wait. You've got to give enough people the vaccine and give enough people the placebo.
Even if there's a pool of volunteers.
Yeah, but you have to see like how many people contract COVID over the next 3 months, right? It takes 3 months to do that. Yeah. And if you do over a shorter period of time, the data is less useful. And also, how long do you wait to see if side effects occur? But in any case, we need to carefully balance rapidly developing the vaccine with good science and, you know, safety, of course. And that requires trust that scientific evidence is guiding the process. And with our, you know, currently poisoned political climate, it's just that trust isn't there, which is unfortunate. Because even if it's all legitimate, who could really know, you know, and that there wasn't undue political pressure, you know, for example. So just, you know, that's why you gotta have hands off, man. You know, politicians just need to have hands off, and you can't pressure professionals in any way. You know, we saw this with the FDA sort of putting pressure on the FDA. Then when they say something 2 days later, it's like, well, where's that coming from? You know, just terrible. It's just terrible. All right, guys. So the award for the most emails this week definitely goes to this news item on nuclear diamond batteries.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Yes.
It was all over the place.
Fire them up.
Yeah, and you wrote about it too, right, Steve?
I wrote about it. We talked about this in 2016.
Yeah,
Bob.
I think 2016, yeah. I talked about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we covered it. This technology. But the news item is that a company is now coming out with their version of the nuclear battery, and they're making all kinds of claims about it that is generating all those emails that we're getting. And, of course, the claims are highly misleading.
Uh-oh.
And you know, again, one of the general rules that we like to remind people of is you can't break the laws of physics, right? You can't get away from these fundamental aspects of reality. So here's the issue. What is a nuclear battery? And the nuclear batteries have been around for almost as long as we've known that nuclear radiation exists, right? Like 100 years. They weren't practical, though.
Right. And you probably have one in your house, right, Steve? It's beta voltaics.
Yeah, beta voltaics means that beta decay generates an electric current, basically.
And smoke detectors work off
of them. Yeah, they're great for things that require very little electricity for a very long period of time. But also, exactly how long depends on what you're making them out of, the half-life of the radioactive material. So essentially, it uses the radioactive decay, right, of radioactive material as the power source so that beta decay event kicks off high-energy particles, and that could cause could bump an electron loose, and that electron could generate generate electricity. So the nuclear diamond battery uses carbon-14, which radioactively decays into nitrogen, and has a half-life of 5,750 years. Now, it's carbon, so you could make a diamond out of it, right? You can make an artificial diamond. So you make an artificial carbon-14 diamond, and the beta decay of the carbon-14 is the energetic event that generates electricity, and then what the company does is they enshroud it in a layer of non-radioactive diamond as a shield, as a protection, and it basically generates a little bit of a current. Now, their idea also, but they're very coy about this. They don't really say like technically exactly what they're doing. Yeah. You have to infer it, and I had to read a dozen articles, where each one maybe I get a little piece of the puzzle. But what I learned is that what they're talking about, the nuclear diamond battery, is that they have the diamond, which generates the current, that connects to a capacitor, right, which stores that electricity. Capacitors can very rapidly charge and discharge energy, but they don't hold a lot of energy. And then that connects to like a traditional rechargeable battery, like a lithium-ion battery. And so essentially, the nuclear diamond battery is charging the lithium-ion battery, and the lithium-ion battery is what you're actually using. But here's where they make statements which are just like not only misleading, they're batshit crazy. They talk about the power density of their battery and that you could recharge your cell phone 5 times an hour. But here's the thing. It seems like they're talking about the power density of their capacitor, not of the nuclear diamond battery itself. And so they're completely mixing things. They're using their power density of their capacitor and talking about the recharge rate as if the source of the energy, because again, the nuclear diamond batteries are not really batteries. They're power generators, right? They're like power cells. They're generating electricity. So they're
constant.
They're,
no matter what you do, they're just... Right.
It's constant.
Right. The batteries are where it's stored.
Right. So they're mixing these variables and then making these completely misleading claims. So they make it sound like you could have a cell phone or a car battery that could last, what they say, like for 28,000 years. Total nonsense.
Wow.
Total nonsense. And this is where you can't get away from the laws of physics, right? And yeah, I wish they would just come right out and say, this is exactly how much energy our batteries produce, and we connect it to a capacitor, whatever. But don't say that. Mm-hmm. All right. So I had to go through the calculations myself. I'm going to try not to get too buried in this, but I spent so much time doing this. I wanted to figure out, like, how much of this stuff would you need to generate a certain amount of power? So my first goal was to, all right, you have an average home in the U.S., consumes 1.2 kilowatts of energy at any given moment on average, right? So it obviously fluctuates greatly throughout the day, but the average power consumption is 1.2 kilowatts. Or, some references say 1.2 kilowatt hours per hour, but, basically a continuous 1.2 kilowatt production. So the nuclear diamond battery, again, the company doesn't say it, but from what I could tell from the research, is that it produces 15 joules per day, per gram. One gram produces 15 joules over the course of a whole day.
What kind of joules? Like diamonds and rubies?
So remember, a watt is a joule per second, 1 watt. So 1.2 kilowatts would be 1.2 thousand joules per second every second for an entire day.
That's right? A lot.
So that's
a lot more than
it's a lot more. So for example, when you crunch all the numbers, like I wanted like an order of magnitude kind of idea what we're talking about here. So for example, if you have a 10 kilogram chunk of this stuff, that would produce 150,000 joules per day, which averages out to 1.74 watts. So if, in order to get 1.74 kilowatts, you would need 10,000 kilograms. Or 1.2, that would be 6.8 thousand kilograms. So let's round that up to, let's say, 7,000 kilograms to produce those 1.2 kilowatts. So that's a lot, right? So if you were going to run your house, you would need about 7,000, an average size house, you would need about 7,000 kilograms of just the diamond. This is not including all this, the equipment
supporting
and stuff.
Infrastructure.
Yeah, all the supporting infrastructure. Sure. Exactly.
So what? How would the volume of that be, Steve?
I'll tell you. I will tell you.
Barn.
That's so 7,000 kilograms or 7 milligrams would be just about 2 cubic meters, because diamond is 3.514 grams per cubic centimeter.
Not horrible.
That's not horrible. That's a big refrigerator.
I'd put that in my basement.
Size of a big room or something.
But it would weigh 7,000 kilograms. That's kind of heavy. But you could certainly see like a modular version of this where you have 500 millimeters on a side. So you need 16 of them, right, to make up 2 cubic centimeters. But that way, you know, your installation could be as many of those smaller modules as you would need.
So, Steve, why lie anyway then? What's the benefit to lying when the thing functions?
They're trying to get investors. But they're talking about your car and your cell phone, right?
Right.
So I think – so this – so we're getting to the physics again, but a couple more numbers really, really quick. So again, I know one resource has all this information. I'm piecing this together. The state of the art apparently is 7% efficiency. The theoretical maximum is 37%. So hey, we might be able to double the efficiency, in which case that would be 1 cubic meter, not 2 cubic meters, let's say. But this will never be in your car. It will never be in your cell phone. It will probably never be in your home either, but that's at least feasible. This, you know, for a stationary source. But here's the thing. Why would you want a source of power that has a 5,700-year half-life? The key concept here is that the longer the half-life, the lower the energy density. That's what you can. There's no way around that. It's a zero-sum game. Because that's the number of beta decays per volume over time. So if you used a shorter half-life radioactive material, you would have a much greater energy density, but you would have, of course, a much lower half-life. So, for example, strontium-90 and cesium-137, which are also nuclear waste material, have a half-life of about 30 years. That means they have 192 times the energy production per mass as the carbon-14. 30-year half-life would actually be pretty good for a car when you think about it. Mm-hmm. The lifetime of that car, you'd still have, you know, 15 years, you'd have half the energy production. So that would be 192 times lighter to produce the same amount of energy. But how much energy do cars use? They use a lot. 34 kilowatt hours per 100 miles, for example, is about an average thing. But here's the thing. You're not running your car on the cell. You're recharging your battery with it. And it's recharging that battery 24/7. So if you had that same 1.2 kilowatt cell, it would recharge a battery with 100-mile range in 28 hours. So that's about, you know, you would basically recharge your battery once a day. You know, with a nuclear generator that weighed 30 something kilograms, or if I had the weight for it, it'd be 144 kilograms of strontium-90 would recharge a 100-mile range battery in 7 hours. But you really wouldn't need that. You wouldn't need it to recharge it in 7 hours because it has all day constantly recharging the battery.
So because it's in the car.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. So you would have your nuclear battery recharging your lithium ion battery, which is what you're actually driving off of. So that would extend your range. And also you'd have just free electricity for the lifetime of the car. And
now, because 100-mile range is low now by automobile.
Yeah, whatever.
Standards.
So if it's a 300-mile range, you know, that a 4.8 kilowatt cell would recharge your battery in 21 hours. So a little bit less than a day, you'd recharge a battery that would take you 300 miles and it would weigh 144 kilograms, which is not crazy for a car.
It's big though.
It's big.
I mean, on top of all the lithium ion batteries electric cars are heavy as it is.
Mm-hmm. But the thing is,
so then you add
you
that?
Could have a smaller battery if that battery is constantly being recharged, even when you're driving it. So you can get the same range, which is with a smaller battery, but with the nuclear generator in there.
Well, could you also just have the nuclear generator stationary and then plug in your car to a stationary charger?
But then it's not a nuclear powered car. Then it's the plug-in hybrid. Yeah, but
you're plugging it into a nuclear powered.
That gets back to just having a station. Yeah, you can have it stationary at your home
while you're driving to 300 miles or kilometers. You're recharging your battery as well. So my question is, how long can you go straight out? Just drive until you can't drive anymore. How far would you go? Because you would go the 300 miles. That would drain the battery. But the time it took you to drive 300 miles, it was charging as well. So
No, but it only takes like a few hours to drive 300 miles.
Okay. Well, no,
it only takes five hours. He said it would take 28 hours to charge it.
Well, it depends on how big your battery is. 28, that was with the 30 kilogram battery. With a 144 kilogram, it only takes 7 hours. Mm-hmm. You'd recharge about 70-80 miles in those 5 hours. But then of course during those 80 miles, you recharge it a little bit more as well. So when you do that, it's almost like the reverse rocket.
Zeno's paradox.
Yeah. So
it sounds like the big limiting factor here is the lithium ion battery.
Oh yeah, sure.
Right. Absolutely. They're just big and heavy, and that we just need to get them smaller.
So
and
so. Yeah, but again, and this is all at the 7% efficiency. If we double the efficiency to 14 or triple the 21%, which is theoretically possible, so my point is it's in the realm of feasibility. It may not be the best option right now with the current efficiency, et cetera, but it's not crazy. But yeah, we may decide ultimately that it's not worth carrying it around in your car, and therefore you need, but it might make sense to have it for your home. But I actually think that the niche for these kind of batteries is going to be like emergency backup for a hospital or for a military installation or for a moon base or for something where having continuous long-term power makes sense. And it's stationary, so it doesn't matter if it's big and heavy.
I disagree, Steve. I'm thinking, a cubic foot, a cubic meter or 3 cubic meters, whatever, in my basement running my entire house for years. That's a – whoo. That's the killer app right there.
Have we
talked
about cost?
No.
It's a quadrillion dollars.
But so the company claims it'll be cost effective to lithium ion batteries. But again, I don't trust anything that they say, but that's what they're saying. However, that probably takes into consideration the fact that they may even get paid to take the nuclear waste off the hands of the people who are currently storing it.
That's a double dip, man. Yeah.
It's a double dip. But that's the brilliance of this. And even if it's not like the best solution energy wise, the other half of this equation is it's taking this out of the nuclear waste stream. It's turning waste
it's reducing pollution
into a battery.
Making,
it's amazing.
You can use.
Right. So
how quick would this come to market? Do you know how far along they are?
Well, they're claiming a few years. They're saying, we had to shut down for COVID, and as soon as we can get back to full production, it's going to be a couple of years. But again, the company was spewing so much hype, and they were so misleading at what they were saying. I don't really trust anything that they're saying.
The sales pitch was on.
But these exist. These exist. This is a proven technology. They exist. Now it's just all about scalability, about commercialization, about what niche is it going to fill, who's going to use it, et cetera.
The practical questions.
Right.
Yeah, the practical
We're talking here about individual cars or about powering our houses, but wouldn't this make so much more sense for grids?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Put in a big warehouse, attach it to the grid, 100%. I agree.
And then take off all that nuclear, we're just talking about that waste. It's like now we're talking about municipal at a municipal level.
But here's the other place. Exactly. And that's where I think it probably would be used for that. But here's the other thing is that these long half-life batteries make sense for very low energy applications where you never want to have to change the battery. So right. a satellite right. or a pacemaker, mm-hmm. anything you put in your body where it just needs a trickle, but it needs it forever, you know.
And it needs to be reliable, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. that's so I think they'll find applications there. And I think hooking it up to the grid is probably going to be the low-hanging fruit in terms of you know, just generating energy. Or again, like there might be microgrids. Microgrids are like supposed to be the wave of the future. Like a town
right.
may get mm-hmm. this and make a microgrid for a neighborhood or whatever rather than an individual house.
Anchorage, Alaska has a whole – has buildings with just batteries on there. Yeah, yeah. There.
Remote
that
locations.
Power the town. That's
if you're
it.
Yeah. off the grid, if you are off the grid, you couple this with a power wall and you're good to go.
Yeah, that means that's yeah, I that'll could do see, it. I could see getting obsessive about this because I love the idea. You know, we lost power in the storms, and you know, I think about the apocalypse and all this. That you have this thing in your basement, you run your house, refrigerator, TV. Probably won't be anything on. You could just run. You could run all your electronics for literally decades with this thing that's what just a few cubic meters. Even if it's 5 cubic meters, that will last you for decades. Off the grid. Off the grid. I mean,
but you know what? With power walls, you can do that with the sun, Bob.
Right. And except at night, yeah.
No, but with power walls, that's why I said with batteries, you can do that with the sun.
Yeah, solar panels are great. You know, I have solar panels, but yeah. their lifespan is like 20 years and they're expensive.
True.
Bob, that's the one that has that would last for thousands of years. For your home, why would you buy something that's going to last for thousands of years? Again, that's more of a, like the city will do that or whatever. If they would do it with radioactive material that has a half-life in the hundreds of years, right. that would be perfect, right? Because first of all, if it were, you know, 500 years instead of 5,000 years, it would be 10 times as powerful. You would only need, you know, 1/10
and much,
the
yeah,
mass.
Much less bomb. Yeah, I mean, you could pass.
And that's long enough. That's long enough to power your home.
Yeah, you could pass it down to your kids and in the apocalypse. Here's your energy source for you and your kids and your grandkids
totally.
In the future. It's going to last us for centuries. Don't worry about any of that shit.
Oh, bring
your
on the
physical
apocalypse.
Home
on.
Is only going to last it. You're lucky if it lasts
yeah,
a few hundred
it will outlast
years.
The home. It will
yeah.
outlast
yeah.
the home.
Yeah, yeah. Your physical home is probably going to last
build a new one over
years.
On top of the battery, man.
Yeah.
You would.
That's amazing.
I just love the idea. That's why I also love the idea of like fission reactors that you could bury in your yard to power your entire town, mm-hmm. like 100 homes or
oh, yeah,
50 homes or even eventually small enough where it's just like one home. And these things would be just modular, made in a factory, delivered, installed, bam, you've got fission electricity for 20 years before it needs to be fixed. Mm-hmm. So those we're going to be, you know, and these big reactors are so expensive. They're finding that a lot of countries would be better off with these little modular ones that could do whole communities, 100 homes.
Yeah, the industry is moving in the direction of small modular reactors. But then again, still the waste is an issue. And this is a way to deal with it, you know. Again, the newer reactors create less waste and they actually use waste from the older reactors, but still there's going to be waste. Like for the carbon-14, it's not the fuel. It's just the graphite that's used to contain it gets radioactive over time. And so, right, this isn't from the fuel. This is just from the structure around, you know, the fission reactor. And so there's a lot of it, tons and tons and tons of it are being generated. So, it'd be just fantastic to be able to turn it into something useful rather than just a problem that needs to be dealt with. All right, let's move on. Jay, tell us about doing instant COVID testing. Is this plausible?
Yeah, so this is actually a question that a lot of people are thinking about. And the short answer is yes, but there's a little complexity to it. So think about how unbelievably beneficial it would be if everybody could test themselves every day to see if they have the coronavirus, right? So can we do it? The fact is the technology does exist. It really comes down to there's some things blocking the ability for us to make it really happen the way that we would need it to. So right now we have two different kinds of coronavirus tests. The first one is called a reverse transcriptase polymerase.
Transcriptase?
I think you mispronounced
Transcriptase polymerase chain reaction or a deluxe antigen test, which I think is even better sounding. So these kind of tests are very accurate. They require a machine to process the tests. You probably have heard of them, and you know that some doctor's offices have them, hospitals have them. These tests are also really expensive. They cost anywhere between $30 and $150 each. And another factor with these tests is that they may take some time to get the results. It could be days or, you know, even a week sometimes. Well, I think a week is more about you're waiting for other people to get their test processed as well. But I think it does take hours to days for these things to chug out the answers. The second kind of test is called a rapid paper antigen test. And these tests produce really fast results, and they're easy to use, and you can take them at home. You know, they cost between $1 and $5 per test. You know, these are a paper strip test that have an antibody embedded into the paper. And when you put your saliva on it, if your saliva has coronavirus, if it's present, the antibodies there are going to interact with the antigens that are there, and it's going to change color of some kind of test positive. This is exactly like a pregnancy test. It's almost identical, right? Very easy, very nice. The downside is these tests are not as accurate as the first kinds of tests. But here's the detail that I think is really interesting. Ideally, we want the test to show a positive during the time when a person is infected and can spread the virus to other people. And now check this out. When you catch COVID, your viral load goes from zero to very much a huge viral load in a short amount of time. And that is the most dangerous part, because you haven't presented symptoms yet, but your viral load is just banging it out like crazy. So you're highly infective. If people could take the tests every day, so let's say they caught it at work and the next day they take the test in the morning. They're like, whoa, I just tested positive. Well, I got to stay home. You call your employer. Look, I'm going to stay home. You call your doctor. Hey, I just tested positive. They're like, okay, stay there. Nice hunker down at home. Right. And then you take it again the next day and you have it. Now, we know that this is a positive because when your viral load is that high, the paper test can pick it up, and it is going to be accurate because you have such a huge viral load. It's not going to misread that. The paper test will not work if you're on the tail end of coronavirus and your viral load is almost gone. The paper test won't work. That's when you need the high end thing in the doctor's office. So what they're saying is, let's use the less expensive tests frequently before and during an infection, because they'll be so much more useful than the expensive tests, because of the fact that you have them in your home and you could be at home taking the test. You don't have to go anywhere. You're already kind of in a space that's safe. You have access to everybody. You're not exposing other people by going to the doctor to take the test. Now, experts are concluding that if we can make these affordable and then we widely distribute them, that they would help us control the coronavirus very quickly. This could be like a quick... All right, so guys, I know I said that this... I made it sound very easy, right? Why don't we do it? Of course we should do it. Well, there are problems. Let me tell you what some of them are. One, of course, we would have to have manufacturers be able to mass produce this. It's not impossible, but it just would take some doing in order to ramp this up. Another problem would be user error, people using the tests, not getting enough saliva on the test, or just making some type of mistake while using it would definitely give you a false negative, because if you have corona and you didn't put your saliva on there, it doesn't show positive. So that's going to be a problem. So the next question is, if these inexpensive tests exist, we know that they work. We know that we can mitigate user error by, you know, having the instructions available and very easy. So the next question here is, if the test exists, which we know it does, if it works, which we know it does, why don't we all have them already? And the answer is that the FDA is holding the developers of the rapid tests to the same incredibly high standards as the first test I told you about, the test that's super accurate. So the question is, why are they doing that and what can we do about it? Well, the why is because it's just efficacy. They're just trying to, you know, make sure that people are using the test correctly, and that we're not just letting companies go out there and make a whole bunch of tests without having, you know, a system in place to deal with it. All right, I get it. We get it. And we want the test to be accurate and safe. But what we need to really do is we need the FDA to modify its regulations so we can mitigate the pandemic with a technology that we have, without holding it up to this standard that we should just shirk off during a pandemic.
Well, are there not different standards, Jay, for like an at-home pregnancy test versus, you know, because everybody knows if you take a pregnancy test at home, it's negative, take it again. If it's positive, go to the doctor.
Go to the doctor. And get a real
get
test.
An actual pregnancy yeah. test. So isn't there already a standard for like at-home tests versus professional medical tests?
I don't think in this specific regard for these coronavirus tests, I don't think that there is that nuance. It's not. That's what
well, I think the point is that generally, yes, but they haven't made that category for home at-home COVID tests.
Yeah.
So annoying.
And yeah, we're not talking about lowering the standards of testing in general or for a hospital test or for whatever for medical tests, but they're saying if we add to our repertoire a down and dirty, cheap home test, you get the trade-off is you could do a lot of them. Everyone could be doing it frequently. And even if it's not as sensitive and specific, it's just your first layer of screening because then we know who needs to go to get the more specific test.
Yeah, the delay doesn't work. We've proven that the delayed test like doesn't really help that much. Now, Steve, they were saying that we should grant the rapid test an EUA, right?
Emergency use authorization.
Right. That's exactly what this whole news article is about, is that the test exists. We need to give it an EUA. Let us use it to mitigate the virus. And they were saying, you know, we'd need 50 to 100 million tests available per day in order to have us, you know, for it to push down the occurrences of the virus.
Even if you did it once every few days, it would be a huge improvement. And then the other thing is when we, you know, if we could roll it out, you have to study it and see what the effect is. But I do think it's worth a try, you know, and it's certainly better than what we're doing now, which is too little, too late, you know. And South Korea, as I mentioned earlier in the show, has demonstrated that doing aggressive testing and contact tracing works. You know, it absolutely works. All right. So we'll keep an eye on that and see what happens with that, see if the FDA gives it an EUA. Bob, what the hell are Blanets?
Oh, man.
So, yeah,
that's
so
not a thing.
A new class of planet has been demonstrated theoretically / mathematically that could be created by and orbit around black holes in the thousands around each specific type of black hole. So think about that. Fascinating. The only thing not cool about them is that damn name they've been given. Blanets. Get it?
Blanets.
Black hole planets. Blanet.
Yeah,
Blanets.
Well.
I'm going to puke. My finger is
in my throat.
I'm already used to it.
All right. So that now is in my top five list along with sparticles. As dumb science names.
Oh my god. So this is in a detailed in two papers published in the Astrophysical Journal. One was in last year and another one recently in the archive in July 2020. Within there, scientists discuss why they believe these types of planets almost certainly exist out there. But Blanets. I mean, even an initialism.
They just call them these type of planets.
Even an initialism, BHP, would be better than Blanets. So, oh well. So you guys know the basics of how ordinary planets are believed to form, right? The consensus is that the planets form, regular planets like the Earth and Jupiter, they form within a protoplanetary disk of gas and dust around young stars, and the materials are in orbit, and they bump into each other, they slowly build upon each other and glom together. And then when they get a gravitational source, when it's real mass and gravity there, then that helps suck in stuff too. So that's kind of the modern theory of how planets form. Now, it may sound surprising, but this new theory of black hole planet formation is not wholly different from that. Lots of similarities. But we're not talking about just like any black holes. This new theory involves the central black holes of galaxies that are going through an AGN phase, which stands for active galactic nuclei. And it's got to be, and it can't be too bright, it can't be too dim, it's kind of like in the middle. Those are the ones that seem to work. But an active galactic nuclei, it's a busy place, right? You've got gas and dust orbiting in an accretion disk, you've got potentially superluminal jets, but above all, you've got this intense radiation that's being released. Now, if you're anywhere near that active central core, it's just going to be too hot and chaotic for these planets to form. But once you get out into the suburbs of the black hole, say something like 10 light years away, the calculations of these researchers showed some very, very interesting results. For example, there's probably a vast environment out there at 10 light years away that's not unlike a protoplanetary disk filled with gas and dust from that central black hole. The radiation from the core drives this fresh material out towards these distant planet-forming region. So it has a constant supply of this material kind of drifting out. And the velocity of these dust grains have been calculated to be right within the sweet spot to encourage glomming together instead of smashing each other to bits, right? Because if you have these particles hitting each other too fast, they're just not going to stick together. They're just going to fracture and fly apart. So it needs to be just within that sweet spot. And also, at that distance, the temperature is low enough to form ice, which might just be a very critical component required to make these dust particles stick together. So, you know, you could have, electrostatics can help with it, but they think that having the ice around these particles could be critical. And they compared it to, like, imagine throwing two rocks at each other and throwing two ice cubes. You know, if anything is going to stick together, you think, it's probably going to be the ice cubes, not the rocks, for sure. And also, finally, their calculations showed that an AGN has about 100 million year lifespan, but these planets could form after only 70 million years or so, 70 to 80 million years. So there's plenty of time for these planets to grow over the course of a typical lifespan of active galactic nuclei. So they calculate then that there could be these black holes with thousands, literally thousands, orbiting this, like each black hole. So lots of planets. I mean, you think, oh, wow, we've got, what, eight planets? Can you imagine 1,000 planets in orbit around one thing? But unfortunately, I mean, for the planets are still, even though there's 1,000 buddies out there, you know, that's a lot of real estate going on. So the closest planet could be a dozen light years away. Imagine if Venus was, 12 light years away from us, and that's the closest, right? I mean, that's what it would be like, most likely in this scenario. So these planets would be, these planets would also have like a million year orbit. So kind of a lonely orbit. They're so far away because it's warm enough out that far, and it's away from all the craziness going on near the core. So it's a good environment, and it's also safe from stars that might come flying in to be absorbed by the black hole. I mean, you're gonna have occasionally some big nasty things come flying through to be absorbed by that black hole. You know, supermassive black holes. We're talking tens of thousands to millions and even billions of solar masses. I mean, that's got to collect somehow. So it's going to be a busy place. But if you have, can you imagine the orbit out 10 light years? That's a huge amount of real estate. So all right. So what kind of planets are we talking about? Or what kind of planets do their theories point to? They would be quite different than the planets and the exoplanets that we're familiar with. There probably wouldn't be any that are quite like Jupiter. They calculate that you couldn't get a gaseous envelope that would be as big as, say, Jupiter. It's just not going to – the numbers just don't work out to have it that big. The rocky planets would form, but that was also very interesting because they found out that the bigger the black hole and the more that you had this outward pressure pushing the gas and dust outwards to form the planets, the bigger the planets that you would create. I mean, we're talking Brobdingnagian planets, 20 Earth masses, 3,000 Earth masses. So these black holes could potentially create worlds that are far larger than anything you will see created from a protoplanetary disk around a star. That's just like huge. So large that it could actually leave the classification of planet and go towards a brown dwarf. It could actually potentially, they say, create...
Is that called a dwarf?
thank God it's not. But a brown dwarf is basically it's kind of like a fail. It's a too big for a planet, too small for a star. So it fuses deuterium, but it's not big enough to fuse hydrogen. So that's the kind of size we're talking about, 3,000 Earth masses. So let's say one other big question: can we detect them? Right? How do you prove this theory? Well, that's a tough question. Right now, we certainly cannot detect them. The closest active galactic nucleus is way too far away for us to see something as small as these big planets or even brown dwarfs. And of course, they're going to be overshadowed by what's going on. If it's an active galactic nucleus, that means it's shining so bright that it outshines the rest of the galaxy. So trying to find even a big planet in that miasma would be impossible right now. Right now, it's not going to do it. Also, it's going to be hidden. It's going to be cocooned in a shroud of dust. Not going to happen. But, I mean, who knows in the future what kind of technology we'll have. I mean, if we may be able to see, something with some technology we haven't developed yet. One other thing, you may be thinking, well, what about our supermassive black hole? It's not that far away. Sagittarius A star is our personal own little supermassive black hole. That's not too far away. It's in the center of the Milky Way. Our black hole is too quiet right now. It's not making any planets. It potentially could have, if it could have been an active galactic nucleus in the past. We're not sure whether it ever was or not. So if it were active, it could have potentially created some planets out there, and then we potentially could detect them with future technology if we could see a red dwarf. I think the scientists were saying something like, if they could detect a red dwarf star that showed evidence of being a brown dwarf, then that would be some decent evidence to say that there's planets in orbit around that black hole. But yeah, so we don't expect to be seeing these anytime soon, if ever. But it's just a very interesting theory, and they seemed I'm curious to see when other people look at their calculations what they say, because it's an interesting theory. Just the idea of a black hole having 1,000 planets that were born right there in orbit around it is just fascinating.
Very cool.
Yeah, planets. Love it.
Planets.
All right.
Can't get past that name.
Evan, tell us about this new way to detect alien biochemistry.
So what's this new device about? So haven't we had these organic life detection equipment on other Mars explorers? Even the Viking missions in the 70s had them? Yep, they did have them. Gas chromatography, mass spectrometry.
Mass spectrometry, yeah.
Yes, or GCMS for short. Looking for the organic signatures, basically just going there and taking a look around for them. But it's not 1975 anymore. C-mold is better. This credit goes to Alberto Ferrian and his colleagues from the Centro de Astrobiologica in Madrid, Spain. They are the minds behind the C-mold project. All right, what will it do? Now, samples will be collected and organic molecules will get extracted, placed into a liquid suspension. Cool. And then it goes through three analytical techniques. The first analytical technique is the microscope. It's going to look for microscale visual evidence of life. Number two is a Raman spectrometer, which looks for ramen noodles, a sure sign that college students are living there. Ramen spectrometer describes detects a substance atomic composition and its organic molecules, assuming it has any. And then number three, a biomarker detector containing antibodies and short DNA and RNA molecules that bind to life-related compounds. Cool stuff. So basically, you know, the three tools you would need to make that kind of analysis right there in real time. You want a kicker to this as well, what they're talking about? It could be suitable, potentially, for detecting life as we don't know it. It's able to detect complex organic biosignatures, even if they don't correspond to the known life molecules. So that's a fascinating idea, whether that actually will be the case or, you know, will it actually be... This makes certain assumptions that it would be detectable with these instruments, but that won't necessarily be the case. But it's a fascinating sort of idea to think about, that you could have the tools there that would pick something up that we would otherwise not be able to detect or analyze, and that wouldn't correspond to life as we know it. But what they were saying, as I looked a little deeper into it, is that they have to scale this down as small as will be physically possible, and also use the absolute minimum amount of liquid possible to get as many tests as possible out of it, which all sort of makes sense. But apparently, you know, maybe scaling it down to a certain point where you need it or where it would last to give you enough testing to get hopefully the results you're looking for. Might be a little bit challenging, but a couple of these devices are already scheduled to be part of one's going up in 2022 as part of the Rosalind Franklin rover, which is scheduled for launch 2022. It'll land on Mars 2023, and that's the Raman spectrometer. That will be one of the three devices on there. And that biomarker detector, the last one I was talking about, that has been included as a payload on a Mars mission, which is proposed to take place in 2026. It's called Icebreaker, but that one has not fully been fleshed out yet. But we haven't had a system that has combined all three of these things into one. And when they're proposing that not only does technology exist, it would work really well together. And they figured out basically the way to do it. And, you know, maybe at some time in this next decade, we're gonna see something like that, especially when we do go to Enceladus, Europa, or mm-hmm. other moons to look for the life.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we need ways to test for life that we don't understand yet, right? Because that's what we're looking for new life.
And this could do it, potentially could, do it.
Yeah. Of course, it's untested, but
right.
Sure. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, Bombas Socks.
Guys, do you think that Bombas Socks are the most comfortable socks possibly in the world?
Well, they're the most comfortable that I've personally worn. I haven't sampled every sock.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, they are incredibly comfortable. And this is the best thing I can tell you. I have several pairs, I wear them, and I always gravitate to them. They are definitely the most comfortable socks that I have. They're just awesome, and you should try them.
I think my favorite part about Bombas, too, is that not only are they like my favorite socks, but you feel good about your purchase because for every pair of Bombas that you buy, they donate to someone in need. They give back to the most vulnerable members of our community. And at this point in time, they have donated over 34 million pairs of socks, especially to individuals who are experiencing homelessness.
I opened my drawer. I got a lot of socks. And some of them are Bombas. And I always smile when they percolate up through my sock drawer and it's their turn next. It puts a smile on my face
it's their turn next.
That no other sock could give.
So give a pair when you buy a pair and get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/skeptics. That's bombas.com/skeptics for 20% off your first purchase.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Guys, last week, I played this noisy. So, guys, any guesses?
The beeping sound reminds me of a countdown of some sort, like an alarm, mm-hmm. But usually which signals some sort of detonation that's about to take place. So that's about all I got out of that.
Not that far off, Ev. That's actually a very good comment. So a listener named Mark Constantine wrote in and said, "Hi, cool noisy. It sounds like the lever a guard pulls in an old school prison to close all the cell doors. And then the doors all slamming shut at the same time." I thought that was a really, pretty cool guess that he made because it does have like that, heavy metal type of clank noise that you would kind of hear in the movies when they do that, when all those cells open or close. That's not correct, but that was a great guess. Another listener named Jody Lesko wrote in, said, "Hi, Jay and crew. For this week's noisy, it seems to be happening in an echoey place. I hear some beeps, then a metal material in motion, and then the motion stopping. To me, it sounds like some sort of very secure door closing, so I'm guessing it's the sound of the hatch closing on the dragon capsule. Thanks." Wow, Jody, that was a cool guess. You know, I'm not so sure about the echo, though, right? Because in order for that echo to happen that you hear, it would have to be in some type of place where the sound could bounce around. So I just don't think that the door would make that kind of an echo, but that was a cool guess. Another listener named Visto Tutti, I don't know if you guys have ever heard of this guy. I don't know. I've never heard of him before in my life. He said, "I think this noisy is a high-power electrical switching. One of those really big circuit breakers, switching huge currents from place to place. The beeping spells out TSSS in Morse code, but that could just be pareidolia." And then he wrote in Italian a phrase that I'm going to mispronounce, but it's senza elettrica siamo animali, which means without electricity we are animals. That was really cool. Thank you, mm-hmm. Visto. You are incorrect, my friend, but we're going to move on to the winner. The winner from last week, Dave Harris, he said, "Hi there, SGU team. I believe the Who's That Noisy from episode 790 is a nuclear reactor pulse with radiation meters bleeping in the background. Love the podcast. Greetings from Wellington, New Zealand." So this is a reactor turning on. Let me play it for you again. Somebody in the audio says, "Sweet." You guys hear that?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's a nuclear reactor turning on.
Yes. It's pretty cool. Like, not much happens. You just see kind of a light go on. And that's it. It's off, and then it's on. And it happens very quickly. So that noisy was sent in by a listener named Michael Jack. Thank you, Michael. That was a great one. He sent it in specifically because I said, man, I've never heard that. I'd like to know what it sounds like when they turn one of those on. So there you have it.
There you go.
I have a new noisy this week. This was sent in by a friend of the show named Craig Good. Craig! We love Craig Good. Craig gave us one of the best experiences of our lives. I'm sure we've said this before, but he used to work at Pixar. And during the movie Brave, after they made the movie Brave, we got the tour of Pixar that had all the Brave stuff in there. And it was, oh my God, it's just one of those special places on Earth that people get to work.
So cool.
So Craig sent in this one. Let me play it for you. I'm going to warn you, this one could be a little intense. So you might want to turn down the volume a little bit. And this one is a little, long. So, because there's a buildup that you have to hear. So check it out. I faded out on that. That is a cool sound, and I would love for you to email me at WTN@theskepticsguide if you think you have any idea what it is. And also, if you heard something cool this week, email me.
Thank you, Jay. One super quick email. This one comes from Derek from British Columbia, Canada. He writes, I was listening to your show mentioning how enjoyable it was to go stargazing and watch the Perseids meteor shower, and I am aware that some of the hosts live in or near the New York area. New York has a requirement to get a permit for stargazing, maybe only in a few parks and beaches, I'm unsure, and was wondering what your thoughts are on this. Doesn't this inherently limit stargazers? Is there a benefit to the permit fee, or is it just revenue for the state? Do you know of other states that do this? Is this an anti-science permit for charging people to enjoy the night sky? Thanks for your time. So this is one of those misleading news stories where it's the opposite of the truth, and it's so frustrating. So this was reported, you know, basically by right-wing media. They said that New York has this new law, like those crazy liberals have this new law where they charge people a permit fee in order to look up at the sky and stargaze. That's what it's going to be like, you know. So that's the opposite of what's actually happening here. There are a few state parks in New York, there could be many of them actually, that are closed after dark, right? That's very common for state parks to close the gates at sunset because they don't want to pay for guards and whatever to people to be on overnight. But because, you know, New York is not a great place to stargaze because of all the light pollution, if the parks are in a good dark sky location, some of them will allow people to enter the park after hours, just for stargazing, right? So you want to enter a park that's otherwise closed, but you want to do it just for stargazing. You could pay a limited fee to get into the park, and that's because they do have to keep people, you know, guards or whatever on duty after hours to allow for this to happen. It's also not new. This has been the law since the 1970s. So this is actually a law designed to facilitate people stargazing by giving them access to otherwise closed parks just so they could stargaze. That's what this is. Mm. You're not charging people for looking up at the sky. You're charging them for access to closed parks so they could have a somewhat dark sky stargazing experience. But, you know, but they turned that into something completely different.
It's, tax on looking up or something.
Yeah, it's 100% misleading. It's just nonsense. So, you know, you can't believe anything. You know, if something sounds incredibly stupid, you just don't believe it. You have to research it. And it took me a few sources before I really found out what was going on here. I suspected this, by the way, from the get-go. This was my first sort of reaction. Oh, they're probably just paying for access to parks after night. But it took me a few references to find that to confirm that that's actually what was happening. But in any case, yeah, just don't believe crazy stuff that you read. All right, we have a wonderful interview coming up with Tim Dodd, the everyday astronaut. So let's go to that interview now. Joining us now is Tim Dodd, the everyday astronaut. Tim, welcome to the Skeptics Guide.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Been really enjoying your YouTube channel. I just watched, I think it's one of your I don't know if it's the most, no, it's not the most recent, but it's the one that came up first on comparing SpaceX and the Boeing Starliner with not only the Soyuz, but also the space shuttle. And you went into way more detail than I've ever seen, and I've read quite a bit about these in the past. So just wanted to start off tell our audience, who are you? How did you get into doing what you're doing? How did you become such an expert on space travel?
Well, yeah, it's funny. I actually used to be a professional photographer full-time. And, you know, I actually ended up, I don't know if, I have this weird backstory where I randomly, kind of as a joke, bought like an old Russian high-altitude flight suit. And then went around taking pictures of myself in the flight suit and kind of photoshopping myself into all these kind of whimsical and juxtaposition-y photographs as kind of an art project. And they kind of started off like that. But I was hiding all these Easter eggs in all the photos. And that was kind of like my nod to spaceflight and spaceflight history. So I was doing a lot of research to take these pictures. And the more and more I was doing research, the more and more I was like, oh, this stuff is awesome. Like, this is really, really cool stuff. And this was right around like 2013, 2014, when, frankly, there was not a lot of stuff going on in spaceflight. You know, it's like SpaceX had only launched a handful of times, and it was a quote-unquote, like, tiny little rocket company that no one was excited about. And, yeah, I just started to really get excited about the history and the engineering. And I ended up going down and shooting a launch as a professional photographer almost – like, I wasn't even that excited about it. I didn't know anything about spaceflight except for I had that spacesuit as a joke, and I was kind of getting more and more into it. So I went to this launch in April 2014. It was a SpaceX launch, and I was disappointed it was a SpaceX launch because I just thought, oh, it's not like a big NASA rocket. Right. That's kind of what I thought.
Yeah.
We get out to the launch pad. You know, this is like with a credentialed media member of the press, and going out to the launch pad, and we get out there, and the rocket had landing legs. And it was the first Falcon 9 booster that SpaceX put landing legs on it. And I was amongst people that were literally snickering, saying, this is the stupidest thing Elon Musk has ever thought of. And he'll never do this. Like, this is just so stupid. And I got hooked. That right there for me, like, I had just walked through the whole Kennedy Space Center visitor complex. And it just almost felt like this, like, graveyard of historical things we had done, like a graveyard of greatness. You know, look at all the things we had done. And I was, like, I was sad when I left there. But then I got out and saw the rocket on the launch pad that had landing legs. Yeah. And I got really excited. And I'm just like, yes, I'm in. And that was my moment of, like, I don't care what it is. I want in on this. Like, I want to learn as much as I can and just be excited.
Tim, I had such a similar experience because as soon as I heard about the retro rockets, it was an instant hook for me because it just screamed back to, you know, my love for science fiction. And I'm like, wait a second, retro rockets actually are real now? Like somebody made retro rockets. It blew my mind. And that was it for me.
Hey, yeah. Tim.
Uh-huh.
I know that we're going to be getting into like the brass tacks of the differences between these different crafts, and we're going to start really nerding out, and like Bob's going to need a fan or like a cold glass of water. But before we get there, I was wondering if you could maybe tell us a little bit about how you went from being excited about a rocket with landing gear to like doing this as a career. Like, how does one go from, I don't know anything about this, to this is what I do now for a living, and I'm supporting myself, and I am kind of like one of the preeminent SciComers in this world.
You know, I think it's just one of those things. These days you can learn any, I think I'm the epitome of, you can learn whatever you want on the internet, you know, for better or worse sometimes. Yeah. with misinformation too, but at least with, you know, with something like rocket science, you can go out there and you can learn absolutely as much as you want.
It's not like rocket science, you know?
It's not brain surgery. It's rocket science.
Yeah. It's just rocket science. So anyone, but the cool thing is, like, it really is, you know, anyone can learn this stuff. And I was just getting so excited following along with what SpaceX is working on. I was getting so excited about all these other things. And I was not finding, that's the funny thing is, I know what it was. I was on Reddit a lot and I was seeing a lot of the same questions asked over and over and over on the subreddit. You know, and like an FAQ section. and all these things that just people had the same question about over and over. And I'm like, you know, obviously people are wanting to understand this stuff. Obviously there's a need for people to have this stuff kind of broken down for them. And it took me a while. You know, at first I was trying to do that through Instagram, which Instagram might have an attention span of 2 seconds. So you're not going to teach anyone about gravity losses of a thrust to weight ratio below 1.1 to thrust to weight ratio or something. You know, like you're not going to get anyone the information through an Instagram post. So I started thinking, you know, maybe I'll just like do a little YouTube video and just see if it resonated with people. I made one. It was in February of 2017. It was kind of the first like scripted video that I shot and edited, and I was terrified and it took way too much work. And I was like, I'll never do it. This is stupid. I could easily do a photo in a day, but this video is going to take a week. Like, this is not worth it at all. And then, yeah, I just kept kind of doing it because traction was growing on it. And, you know, I just had more and more ideas on things I could help break down and make more tangible and easier to understand. And it's weird. I actually quit my job as a photographer in 2016 so that in 2017 I could become quote unquote full-time everyday astronaut. And at the time I didn't even know what that was going to be. I was trying Twitch. I was trying Instagram. I was doing YouTube stuff. I just knew that I was excited and that, you know, whatever you can put your mind to, you know, you can make it happen. Mm-hmm. And so by the end of the year, it's pretty clear that this could be a career. So I kept going with it.
Awesome.
Can I ask you a kind of a off the cuff personal question before we get into some technical questions on spaceflight? Looking at your video, do you have heterochromia?
I do have heterochromia, and you're one of the, you'd be surprised how few people notice that. So the fact that you've noticed that already, wow.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, what does that mean? That you could see backwards in time? Like, what is this?
You know,
it's
two different colored eyes.
It's different colored
heterochromia.
Eyes.
Time.
Well, it's actually, I can see the full spectroscopy of the entire, I see everything, ultraviolet and everything, because of the two different colors. So,
yeah, that's how that works.
All right. One of the videos of yours that I've watched that I really liked was comparing, the technical details of the new crewed space vehicles, the Dragon, you know, the SpaceX Dragon and the Boeing Starliner with the Soyuz and the space shuttle. At the end, you were going to tell us what your favorite was, and you sort of did, but I came away thinking you hedged your bets there a little bit. So what do you think? Do you prefer the Starliner or the crewed Dragon?
Oh, you're putting me in a position I try to make my fans not do, because I want people to always be like excited about everything and, you know, be quote unquote hashtag team space. You know, we're all just in this to celebrate all the programs and, you know, cheer, you know, kumbaya and sing about all the exciting things coming.
All right, let me put it this way. But I know they each have their advantages and disadvantages, but if you could take a ride on one or the other, which one would you pick?
My fans would have no surprise knowing that I would day and night choose the SpaceX Dragon capsule.
Me too.
Is that just because it's like more comfortable? Like it's cooler on the inside? Like you would enjoy the trip more?
Yes, but also, frankly, to be completely blunt and honest, seeing how Boeing has not performed as well with their safety procedures and safety measures, especially with their demonstration flight at last December, they had many problems that would have been that just were almost inexcusable, you know. And considering they actually received more funding for timeline assurance and kind of being like, you know, we've done this before. We're the kings at building spaceflight material. I was disappointed because I expected big things from them and they kind of dropped the ball. So, and SpaceX, on the other hand, had to prove themselves kind of from scratch and they've been blowing me away. So,
Any sense why they dropped the ball?
Oh, I think there's been a culture of mismanagement where I think they've frank, and I'm going to be totally frank about my opinions here. These are just my opinions. I feel like Boeing has invested more in lobbying than they have in their own engineering and labor per se. Like they've kind of lost touch with their roots because they've been, you know, one of the absolute leaders in aerospace in the past. And, you know, we have many, many examples of negligence, you know, between the 737 MAX, but also just there's been multiple things where it's like, guys, you really got to get your act together. And I hope they've had some awakenings. They've had some systematic change.
Yeah, when your stock drops 50%, that tends to happen.
Yeah, that tends to make a difference. And I'm hoping that all those things make an actual impact, a tangible impact in their programs, because I think it matters immensely for them and for our country and for the world of space exploration.
I agree with that.
Tim, do you think, you know, the way I was looking at it, because I'm a huge fan of all this as well, SpaceX was a startup. and there wasn't like a huge history of a company there and all the red tape. Like, they started this company and they started to develop their vision and they went for it. You know, with Boeing, it's like everything is mired down in red tape and all of like the weight of a 50-year-old company. And I think it took like a semi-crazy CEO to make SpaceX happen, you know, just like Apple. Like, it took a super aggressive driver to pull this thing off. And they killed it. I mean, SpaceX, love or hate Elon, right? Yeah, and I don't care what anybody thinks. I don't care for the guy as an individual. I care for him as the CEO of that company. He pulled it off. He even said, do you remember when he said, like, I never thought we were going to even come close to this? At one point, he made this comment, like, who would have ever thought we were going to be doing what we're doing right now?
Oh, yeah.
But I do wish he would, like, stay off Twitter. Just saying.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Say that about a lot of people.
No, I think you're absolutely right. You know, I think he has been just crazy enough to pursue the things that were almost considered impossible by, you know, by traditional senses. And I think that Boeing has kind of not needed to innovate, frankly. You know, they've been okay just incrementally doing the bare necessity. And SpaceX, is their goal is so much bigger than the commercial crew program or commercial resupply, or even this upcoming Artemis program. Their goal at the top of the entire company, you walk in there, it's obvious. They're literally, every person will tell you their goal is to get to Mars. And when you have that ridiculous and ambitious of a goal, everything else almost becomes trivial, you know, and all of it becomes in pursuit of that one goal. And I used to, when I swear the first time I walked in there was, I actually got a tour in 2014 or 2015, no, 2016 was when I first went in there. And I remember laughing still a little bit, like, kind of, you know, obviously to myself, like, yeah, your goal is going to Mars. Yeah. I just really had a disconnect with that overall vision and with that being remotely a reality. And nowadays, that's becoming more and more of a reality for sure.
Yeah. Before we get to Mars, I wanted to ask you one thing that I haven't been able to satisfy myself about with the Dragon capsule, because I don't feel like we're ever getting the full story from SpaceX. And that is, why did they forego the dry landing of the Dragon capsule? That's a great question.
Whew. All right. So for those of you that
did you guys hear Tim just plugged in the module? He just hear him click in the accessing information. Here we go.
So for those of you that don't know, the Dragon capsule has it's 8 separate abort motors in pairs that are, like, there's 4 pods around it with pairs of these Super Draco abort motors. Now, these Super Draco abort motors are there in case, you know, if the rocket, if they're ascending and all of a sudden something happens to the booster or something happens, they need to abort off of the vehicle. Those things light up and they pull it free and clear, and then they pull the chutes and the crew is safe and sound. But of course, because these are liquid fueled rocket boosters and not solid rocket boosters, they can actually be precisely controlled enough to be able to land. And as you mentioned, Stephen, that was exactly their original goal, was to, if you don't need to use them in abort, they're still full of fuel, and they therefore could still be used to land. Well, in 2017, Elon sat down with the ISS conference with NASA, and they kind of talked about it pretty openly there, saying basically NASA thought it'd be extremely hard to certify that for human use, basically. You know, the actual, how do you ensure that this is safer than, as safe as parachutes to an objective, you know, quantifiable amount, right? Because everything these days is a risk of, like, a calculated risk for NASA. In order to be able to certify it, they literally go through and do their homework on what are the odds of this failing, this failing, this failing, this failing. They add it all up and say, is it beyond, you know, 1 in 270 chance of loss of crew? And I'm pretty sure at the end of the day, it was just like, you know, this, as cool and futuristic as that is it really going to be safe enough, first off, for human life? Because that's first and foremost important. But also, is it actually even really worth it? Because now you have other things to get around, like the landing legs are going to have to protrude through the heat shield, which is not ideal, because you could have places where hot plasma can, you know, get to your spacecraft. You had there's a situation or a blackout zone where you'd be going, you'd be slowing down initially under, like, the propulsive landing, and all of a sudden you'd be going, you'd still be high up, but now you wouldn't be fast enough, or you'd be too low where even if the engines all of a sudden cut out, you would no longer be able to pull a parachute. And so there's some blackout windows And at the end of the day, it's just like, is all the stuff worth it? Because the other big part is they wanted to land the Dragon capsule on Mars. So they were going to prove it here on Earth, use that system here on Earth, make that totally rudimentary and kind of their, you know, their bread and butter. But come to find out, a dense, small surface area like the Dragon capsule has a relatively small 3.7 meter wide heat shield on the bottom, 12 foot wide heat shield. And it's actually a really small surface area compared to how heavy the vehicle is. So it does a very poor job of aerobraking on Mars. And it doesn't really have enough margin. It's just not the right vehicle to land on Mars. And instead of SpaceX, just they didn't want to be a sunk cost fallacist and keep pursuing a vehicle that doesn't align towards landing on Mars.
But parachutes don't work as well on Mars either because you have that 1% atmosphere.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
How are you going to land on Mars then?
Combination.
You have to do propulsive landing. That's an absolute must. Anything over, you know, anywhere near a ton, like we see with Curiosity and Perseverance, they have to have a parachute to slow them down to, you know, as much as the parachute can, and then you have to retropropulsively land. But you know, the vehicle is just so, the Dragon capsule does not have enough aero surfaces and enough surface area to really do, you know, to take advantage of that stupid 1% atmosphere. Like if that atmosphere was any thicker, they likely could have got away with a lot different vehicle, more like the Dragon capsule. But when it is that thin, you really got to use as much of it as you can to bleed off your velocity.
Or just make a parachute that's 100 times larger than
So SpaceX went for the really high-tech way to do a dry landing. And now they're doing a splashdown. So they had to completely give it up. Whereas Starliner just said, we're just going to use parachutes and basically balloons, you know, to dry land, and that's going to work.
Yeah, and it does really surprise me that SpaceX didn't end up doing something more akin to what the Starliner is doing. Because the Starliner is, landing on land using basically airbags. The Soyuz capsule lands on land, but it uses these very, if you ever notice a Soyuz landing, it always looks like they smack the ground super hard. That's not actually it smacking the ground. It's because they do fire these little retro rockets, there's just a pack of retro rockets that fire just before touchdown to slow it down to a nice soft landing. So I'm surprised that SpaceX didn't do something more like that instead of bothering with the ocean recovery. But they did have a lot of experience already recovering the previous Dragon capsule in the ocean. So for them, it was almost like, hey, we can just keep using the same stuff we've been using. So maybe that was easier in the long run.
How damaged does it get?
You know, they are already going to be using the one that just flew Bob and Doug in May and they returned in July. They're going to be using that again next year. And they were estimating only 3 to 4 months of refurbishment. Mm-hmm. The Dragon 2 capsule that flies crew had a lot of upgrades from Dragon 1. And Dragon 1 almost half of the flights were reflown already on Dragon 1. And that was not necessarily optimized for reusing after a splashdown, mm-hmm. but they still made it work. So they learned a lot of things from Dragon 1 that they could then iterate on and improve for Dragon 2 to be more reusable and a quicker turnaround and make it make even more sense to be able to reuse it after a splashdown.
The fact that they went for reusability, that alone was such like a ballsy maneuver that NASA would never do. And the fact that SpaceX like fully committed to it. And now look at what happened. We have reusability.
But the space shuttle was reusable, Jay.
Oh, I know. But you know what? I'm talking about launch systems, being able to reuse other components that we normally wouldn't reuse. Like it is an innovation that NASA wasn't willing to go to.
Well, you know, I slightly have to disagree with you because NASA would have loved to do that. And NASA had two different programs that were hoping, like the DCX program. I don't know if you guys have ever seen footage of it, but it's this program in the 90s that was its vertical takeoff and landing just like the Falcon 9. It flew up to like, I think they had a flight of 3,000 or 4,000 meters. So really high altitude flights, really crazy looking flights too. Like it'd fly almost sideways and then land propulsively just like the Falcon 9. And that was an incredible, I mean, that was funded by NASA as a potential reusable vehicle. And same with almost in the same time frame, they're also looking at the Venture Star, which is, it was an SSTO, so single stage to orbit, giant, like this weird looking flying, almost like a B-2 bomber, kind of this big flying wing that had a giant aerospike engine on the bottom. Super weird vehicle. I still love it. And that also was pursuing full reusability, but both of those programs got canceled for just basically different political reasons, unfortunately. And I think that's more the problem with NASA, isn't that they don't want to do this stuff. NASA wants that stuff, but they also can't embed themselves in that much risk because their funding changes constantly. They're, you know, they're at the whim of Congress, which who wants to be at the mercy of the United States Congress? No one wants that.
Yeah. I guess Tim, like I was, you know, and I've read about this a long time ago. I think it was the risk thing that I was like, yeah, they just don't, the risk is way too unnecessary, I guess would have been a much better way to put that. But it's not that the technology is so unbelievably useful once you have it, though. Like the cost savings are going to be phenomenal. The fact that we can, you know, the fact that we're going to be able to reuse these capsules and a turnaround, we're going to be like having them in rotation like crazy and reusing and reusing. It's going to be awesome.
No, that's exactly right. And that's the thing that gets me so excited because it's so, it really, I mean, it makes sense. Like this is a duh. Why didn't we do this forever ago? And like it's not a novel concept. Like stop throwing this crap away. What are you doing, you know? But at the same time, like yeah, once it got proven and once SpaceX really showed the industry that yeah, we can actually do rapid turnaround of this stuff and they're flying boosters now in under 2 months, and I wouldn't be surprised if in the next year we see them flying the same booster in well under a month. I mean, I think they're getting to that cadence, and that's, you know, that's substantial.
Yeah, that's a big deal. Tim, I got to tell you, I've watched a ton of your videos. I watched videos of yours way before, I knew who you were, right? I just was like, you were a guy on YouTube that was telling me stuff that I loved to hear about. I love your show. And I think your show is one of those, it makes space flight super accessible. I love the fact that after I watch one of your videos, I can actually discuss it with people and I can sound moderately intelligent about all the details, which is awesome. So I highly recommend anybody listening to this show, if you like or are a fan of spaceflight, go check out Tim's channel because he does it so exquisitely good.
Tell you guys that I've been you guys are half the reason why I started doing science communication, though.
Oh, no. Just,
yeah, I've been watching you guys since 2012, probably, or listening since 2012. And been a huge, you know, I guess you guys taught me the importance of scientific literacy and critical thinking. And I always will use that in the back of my head as an important lesson, especially in like today's society how do you reach people? And I think the best way that I've found for me and my style of communication is to get people excited. And then through doing that, they'll learn the less of the lessons along the way. And you guys definitely helped do that for me. So.
Oh, well, that's awesome.
It's amazing.
All right, well, Tim, thank you so much for joining us. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's truly my pleasure.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. This is the longest running segment in our show.
You know, wow.
That's right. Started from the beginning.
Three regular news items. Are you guys ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Here we go. Item number one. An extensive study finds that political ads have an insignificant effect on voter choice, regardless of any variable considered, such as political affiliation, location, and positive versus negative ads. Item number two. A traffic simulation finds that small numbers of autonomous vehicles, less than 20%, could significantly slow overall traffic. And item number three, a new study suggests that oxygen from Earth has been reacting with iron on the surface of the moon. Kara, I don't think you've gone first in a while.
No, it's been a bit. Okay, so removing the variance from political affiliation, location, and positive. Well, that can't possibly be true. Not on, what is it, undecideds. I can't believe that's still a voter block. A traffic simulation finds that small numbers of autonomous vehicles, fewer than 20%, not that small, could significantly slow overall traffic. Small numbers of autonomous vehicles. What does that even mean? I don't get
it. So in other words, if like on the roads, if less than 20% of the vehicles are autonomous, they're self-driving cars.
Yeah.
And the other 80% are people driving. Right? So if you have a hybrid situation, right, where you have
a
mixture of autonomous and person-driven cars, if the ratio of autonomous vehicles is low, it actually slows down overall traffic.
Regardless of how fast they're driving?
You know, that's, you take it for what it is.
Okay. And a new study suggests that oxygen from Earth has been reacting with iron on the surface of the moon. I mean, that seems plausible. The traffic one seems plausible. The voter one seems overtly incorrect, which means it's probably science. I hate these ones. I hate these ones where there's a clear, obvious answer, and then it ends up not being right. But I'm gonna go with my gut and say political ads do have an effect, and that's there's so many strategists that put so much money into this. They must run their own studies. Otherwise, why would they spend so much money on it? I don't know. I'm gonna say that's the fiction, the political ad one.
Okay, Evan.
This is an extensive study, first of all. So I don't know. I imagine that means looking over a very long period of time, maybe? Is that what they mean by extensive here, Steve?
Yeah, it's a lot of data, to say that.
Okay. That it has an insignificant effect on voter choice, regardless. Well, the general thought out there is that you've got, on any given election or candidate or what have you, 40% of the people are going to go one way, 40% the other. You fight for the 20 in the middle. So the question, I think, is does it have an effect on those voter choices? I don't know that it has that great an effect. They may, you know, I get that there are industries and a lot of money invested and groups and PACs and things that, you know, are go hard and go very deep into this. But the actual effect may not be there, I think. Number two, the traffic simulation. A small number of autonomous vehicles could significantly slow overall traffic. I don't know about that one. Assuming that the autonomous vehicles drive either, you know, correctly according to the rules of the road and are able to be programmed to work within the traffic patterns, I'm not quite sure how that all works out. But you would think that, I mean, a lot of people suck at driving, and they're the ones who kind of make traffic slow overall. Maybe if you had autonomous vehicles that you'd have greater efficiency. The opposite might be true there. The last one about oxygen reacting with iron on the moon. Okay. Never heard that before, but I don't know. I think that one also could be the fiction. I'll say the traffic one. I think with the autonomous vehicles, it increased efficiency. It didn't slow things down.
Okay, Bob.
For the first one, political ads, I could make sense of the fact that these ads aren't having an insignificant effect. Yeah, I think it could definitely. I wouldn't be surprised if it were small. The third one here, oxygen from the Earth. The question is, how does the oxygen from Earth get to the moon? I suppose that we are slowly losing some atmosphere here and there that eventually makes its way to the moon over a long time. So maybe that's what they're talking about. And so that I can make that make sense in my head. The second one, the traffic simulation. Yeah, I agree with Evan. I think if we had 15 to 20% autonomous cars, I think it could potentially improve traffic. So I'll say that's fiction.
And Jay?
So I'll take these in reverse order. So a new study that suggests oxygen from the Earth has been reacting with iron on the surface of the moon. So, you know, first thing I thought of was, well, okay, how is oxygen from the Earth getting to the moon? You know, what could that possibly be? And the only thing I can think of would be
space
possibly
straws.
The solar wind is the only thing that is like you would consider be the only force that's actually, you know, that's happening. It's not gravity because the gravity is not strong enough. What's the only other force that could do it? And then I'm thinking, well, can the solar wind actually? Well, okay. So how about if the moon is on the other side of the Earth? So it goes the sun, the moon, the sun, the Earth, and the moon. Then I could see the solar wind being able to do that. I still don't know. I mean, I'm just making a guess here, but I think it's plausible. So that one's, you know. Then now let's go to the traffic simulation with the automated vehicles. Now I do think that in the transitionary period in the beginning, because the automated vehicles are going to be driving slower than most people do, I could see it slowing traffic down because they're going to be following the speed limit, which, you know, I would assume most people don't. So I just think straight up, yeah, I agree with that. Probably need a lot more of them before and, you know, and a lot more, many, many years of experimenting and knowing exactly how to you know, the software and the interaction between the cars and everything. So sure. So that leaves the first one, which, okay, that's the fake.
Okay, so you guys, we have an even split between one and two. So let's start with the third one. A new study suggests that oxygen from Earth has been reacting with iron on the surface of the moon. You all think this is science, and this one is science. This is cool. So again, the study suggests that because it's, you know, we don't know for sure. What they found was that there's hematite on the moon from spectroscopic analysis.
Yeah.
And that is iron mixed with oxygen. And so there is no oxygen on the moon. So where is it coming from? Is it coming from the, you know, tiny amounts of water? That's possible, but still you need a source for that oxygen. And what they found was that it's far more on the near side of the moon than on the far side of the moon. And it's more at the upper, and they found that, they found it at the high latitudes. So the hypothesis is that the oxygen is coming from the upper atmosphere of the Earth when, you guessed it, the solar wind strips it away.
Hey.
And, Jay, you're correct. When the Earth, when the moon is in the magnetotail of the Earth.
Jesus, I nailed it.
Yeah.
Right down to the magnetotail.
And that this has been happening over several billion years. You know, even though it's a very tiny, tiny amount, over several billion years, it could be enough to explain what we're seeing on the moon. So, you know, hematite on the moon. Still, you know, obviously I just said suggest. It's not proof, but that seems to be an acceptable, plausible explanation. All right. So should we go to one or two? Let's just keep going backwards. A traffic simulation finds that small numbers of autonomous vehicles, less than 20%, could significantly slow overall traffic. Evan and Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Jay and Kara, you think this one is science. So I guess the question is, where do the lines cross, right? Where, how many autonomous vehicles do we need in the mix before they start to improve the flow of traffic?
Right. More than 20%.
So this one is the fiction.
Yeah, it worked out.
Because what the simulation showed was that even in small numbers, it improves the flow of traffic, which is good.
Wow.
But what they did was if the autonomous vehicles are not just driving by themselves, but are networking together to control the overall flow of traffic,
right,
they could actually, even a very small number of autonomous vehicles, if they're working together, could influence the flow of traffic and make it more efficient.
Yeah.
It can have a positive effect on the efficiency of traffic.
Hive mind working there
yeah,
together.
Yeah, exactly.
I was actually thinking that, yep.
But it doesn't have to be that many. It doesn't have to be that many.
Wow.
Percentage-wise.
Okay, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I was wrong.
Yeah,
yes, you were
right about
Mr.
the
magnetotail.
Solar wind.
So they found a 40% enhancement in traffic flow efficiency with only 5% of the vehicles being on time.
Wow, that's big. I'm so surprised.
That's awesome. A great return on that kind of investment.
A 27% reduction in fuel consumption.
I think I always assumed, just like, you know, it's funny because Bob, you were saying, I think it was you, Bob, were saying the same thing I think, which is that like people suck at driving.
Yeah.
And so I assumed that you needed more than like half of the cars to be autonomous before it actually made an improvement.
Well, that's exactly why they did the simulation, because that was the question. How many do you need in there? But 5% was enough.
Wow.
All right. This means that an extensive study finds that political ads have an insignificant effect on voter choice, regardless of any variable considered, such as political affiliation, location, and positive versus negative ads, is science.
Wow.
That they had no,
insanity.
I know. It didn't matter if you were a Republican, if you were a Democrat, if you were independent, if you were in a swing state, if it was a positive ad, a negative ad, it
your
didn't
mind is
matter.
Made.
Why do they spend so much money on
political so,
you can't crack the biases of people.
I also, but there's a couple of nuances here. One, I said voter choice. So that like which candidate they choose was one of the things they looked at, and that was statistically insignificant. So there was no significant effect. But if you just look at the attitude towards the candidate, there was a statistically significant but really tiny effect, like super tiny. Here's the thing. They looked at Evan, you asked how many was a major study.
Yeah.
How extensive? They did a representative sample of 34,000 people through a series of 59 randomized experiments. So they collected a lot
that's
of data.
Thorough.
When you collect that much data, even teeny tiny effects can be statistically significant. So what they found was that the effect on rating a candidate favorably compared to like placebo ads that weren't about the election was 0.05 of a point on the 5-point scale. So that's, 0.05 of 1 point.
Jeez.
On a Likert scale is nothing.
Jeez.
The ad's effect on who they would vote for was 0.007%, which was not statistically significant. Now, but they say, so of course the question is, why do they spend so much money on ads? Ads don't move the needle, but what they do is, what they do is that if you have low name recognition, they increase your name recognition.
Mm.
But also, they didn't study the effect of an ad campaign, only individual ads.
Oh, come on, people.
Did they look at, Steve, whether or not it increases people's chances of voting at all?
I didn't see that in the in the write-up, no. But that's a good point. It could affect voter turnout, not who they're going to vote for. But also, they said that in a close race, even a tiny statistical effect in a swing state or two might make a difference. So, they weren't saying that there's no point to political ads, but they're just saying that they don't move the needle that much.
It seems like a pretty big waste of money to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, name recognition. And again, this is something I've heard for years, that really the only effect it has is name recognition. And once you get name recognition, because I think ads are ads. People they know their ads.
Yeah, but when you're talking about a general election, everybody knows the name of the two candidates. Like at that point, it seems like they're moot. Put the money somewhere else.
Exactly. Put it in a voter registration or get out the vote or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or just prep for your debates. Yeah. I don't know.
Awesome smear campaign.
They don't move the needle much either. But negative ads didn't work either, Evan. That's the thing. Mm-hmm. Negative ads didn't work. So interesting. Any interest?
All right,
Evan. Evan, give us a quote.
Certain people, men of course, discouraged me, saying science was not a good career for women. That pushed me even more to persevere. And that was said by Francois Barré-Sinoussi. She is a French virologist, director of the Regulation of Retroviral Infections Division in France, Paris, France. And she is also a Nobel Prize recipient, Physiology or Medicine, in 2008, together with her former mentor, Luc Montagnier, for their discovery of HIV.
Yeah. And Luc, wasn't he a homeopath or something? He embraced some pseudoscience after he got the Nobel Prize.
That's right. Yeah, he went down a dark path.
Yeah.
But
should've listened
as far
to
as I know, she didn't. Yeah, exactly. So she gets the quote tonight, and deservedly so.
Again, it was 12 years ago, not that long ago, but a long time ago when it comes to, I think, this sort of issue. And it is amazing, that, women in STEM careers, everyone I've ever spoken to has had something similar to say.
Right? Oh, yeah.
That whatever, their expectations were lower. There was some significant sexism along the way. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it myself in my medical career, more so like 20 years ago than today, definitely, 100%. But definitely, I've seen it.
Yeah. It's super common, even today.
Yeah, men, absolutely.
Men still fighting the fight. Keep fighting.
Well, cultural beliefs like that are just hard. They're just slow to change,
Yeah.
That's just the way it is. All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Good show, Doctor.
Roger that, Steve.
And don't forget to tune in Friday at 5:00 Eastern Time for our live stream where we just hang out and chill and maybe do a quiz show and answer your questions.
Check out my new desk.
Yeah. Can't wait, Bob.
Unicorns this week. So we'll see you guys then. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.